नमस्ते, गुड मॉर्निंग। वी रिसेंटली हैड अ रिट्रीट इन द सेक्रेट टाउन ऑफ शिरडी एंड अ टॉपिक विच वॉज टच्ड अपॉन वॉज लव, परहैप्स द मोस्ट मिसअंडरस्टूड वर्ड। So, I would like to read out a few sentences. These are pointers from a Mahabhakta, a great devotee of Shirdi Sai Baba. He had a very special relationship with Sai Baba, extremely strong bond, and a very unique experience that decades after Baba dropped his body, he came and actually visited Anna Sahib and stayed in his home for a period of time. So Anna Sahib would give satsangs himself, and this is a short passage on love. So I'll go through an exploration of it briefly, and then we can open up to anything anyone would like to share or any questions they may like to ask. Love helps conquer oceans of calamities. Love makes the mind firm and determined. Love makes life noble. When spiritual inclination rises to great heights, it is love. The next step is devotion. And what is love? Love is God. God is love personified. When the heart is full of love, the jiva is in the proximity of God. If he is aware of it, then spirituality is pleasure and happiness. Without love, that is, without God, the world is full of sorrow. There is sweetness in love and devotion, and in this sweetness lies the bliss which is necessary for Shanti. That is, calmness or tranquility of mind. I'm going to repeat this last sentence because it is of utmost significance. There is sweetness in love and devotion, and in this sweetness lies the bliss which is necessary for Shanti. That is, calmness or tranquility of mind. The eyes are the witness to the experience of love. When divine light appears before the eyes, a devotee enjoys the experience of love. This is what is called Netra Sakshatkar. So you see this love in Advaita is not much spoken about. My teacher would also not speak much about it, because he would say that we are normally conditioned to think of the word love as the polaric opposite of hate, because this is the realm of duality. But what this love is pointing to is a transcendental love. You could call it a love that rises above the polarity of love and hate. So you could even say it is a love that has no opposite. Nisargadatta Maharaj would say, "All I ask is that you don't harm anyone." Rameshji would say, All I ask is that you don't hate anyone. You see, because if there is a deep understanding that all there is consciousness, and we are all instruments through whom consciousness functions, then it begets the question, can consciousness really hate itself? So when there is no other in my daily living to hate, what it actually means is that there is no other. When there is no other, it means there is no me as separate from the other. And when there is no me as separate from the other, it means consciousness is all there is. Now, this can sound theoretical. In daily living, what does it mean? It means when I have the total acceptance that everyone I meet in the course of the day has been designed by a higher power, given a set of genetics, a set of conditioning since childhood, on the basis of which they have developed a worldview, and on the basis of which they make decisions. They say things, they express themselves. When I can see this, that everyone is shaped by the one source consciousness, that means there is a total acceptance that nobody is the doer of what they say and what they do. This total acceptance is a key pointer in understanding what we refer to as Maya, which means people appear to be doing things and saying things, but it is that one source consciousness functioning through them as individual consciousness, expressing itself in the waking state and the dream state as individual consciousness. So if I live this understanding, it means one and only one thing. And I am grateful to Joel Goldsmith for mentioning this sentence, that if I live this understanding, my relationship is no longer with people, but it is with God. And if we push this further, if my relationship is no longer with people, but with God, because the awareness is constant, that everyone is an equal representative and representation of that one source, and therefore my relationship is with God, then it means one has realized what could be termed as Advaita Bhakti. Advaita Bhakti. The bhakti of not two appears as two, but it is not. So this relationship with God, when it is being lived through mundane relationships, Wouldn't we call that being in love with God? Because we are relating to God. Each encounter, each experience with a human being, and even the animal kingdom for that matter, is now reflecting our relationship with God. And if this understanding is prevalent all the time in one's mind and heart, would not that be called love? That which is always with you now. Always think about it all the time. Always see things from that perspective is what is dearest to you going forward. So, would not that be true love? True love for the divine, one could call it. So, you see, the issue is that the dualistic love is very form-based, a specific form to love, a specific form to hate. And the love of bhakti, let's say I have a certain deity, whether it is Krishna, whether it is Jesus, again, it becomes form-based because I'm in the world of form, manifestation, and it's more relatable to relate to an image of, let's say, a deity. But in many cases, it stops there. Which means my relationship with the deity is beautiful. I'm lost and immersed in it. But my relationships in daily living are a mess. Then what is the point of that bhakti? Then I must question my bhakti. So this understanding of love in Advaita, one will conclude, is more like an unconditional acceptance of what is, of people the way they are, rather than wanting to change them. And the unconditional acceptance of myself, including all my flaws, which I think I have. Knowing that I too have been shaped by this higher power. Yes, going forward, if I feel I can improve in some way, I do what I think and feel I should do. Now, knowing that the results are not in my hands, they are in God's hands. So, even the quest for self-improvement is no longer a burden on me. Trying to be a better person and feeling guilty if I fail in that quest. Who fails? If the understanding is as God itself is making that effort through you, does it mean God has failed? On the spiritual journey, there is no such thing as failure. So, this love, which has no opposite, one could say is transcending from seeing from with the eyes of duality through the eye of singularity. It is very simple. If I see God in everyone, that is the eye of singularity. Everyone. Sabka Malik Ek. Is what Sai Baba used to say. He did not mean everyone's master is one as in one form. He literally meant everyone's master is one, not two. You see? And when we are seeing people through the eye of wisdom, the eye of Shiva, then that is the divine light which is shining, as Anna Sahib has said. It is not restricted to some esoteric experience of seeing light. The more I think about God, which basically means the more I realize individuals are no longer the doers of their actions as I thought them to be, then I am an expression of the love for God. That is what prompted my teacher to say towards the end of his life, love each one as if you created them. And Osho was quite right that such kind of a love, he was referring to the Buddha's love, can be perceived as a cold love. Cold. Because in the dualistic love, we like that kuchiku, warm, cuddly feeling. But the sage, who has a total and complete acceptance of God's creation, without the least possible interest in trying to change it, a total acceptance of people exactly the way they are, is a representation of that love, which has no opposite. One could call true love being a quiet love. It is a love that does not need words to express itself. It is simply a way of being. It is a way of relating with people where I don't need words to convince them about my love for them. Whether it is recognized or not is irrelevant. Because this kind of love is not looking for appreciation, nor is it looking to get something in return. It is now simply the way I am, the way I engage and interact with people. And therefore, Anna Sahib says it leads to shanti. Even love leads to peace. Even love leads to peace. That is, as he says, calmness and tranquility of mind. So we cannot escape that. If one is on the bhakti path, one has to ask oneself, am I established in sukha shanti in daily living? If I feel I am a beacon of love, I love people, I love my family, etc., etc., does that translate into a state of equanimity? Or is it the opposite? I'm very emotional, fluttering, palpitating. Because we are used to dualistic love, we may find, just as an example, we go to a sage or someone we consider awakened or enlightened, and we miss the fact that there is a total acceptance of the way we have been made. And we tell this person in front of us, oh, you don't love me. You are not saying loving words to me. You see? The ego wants acknowledgement of its presence. It is not willing to dissolve in the total acceptance of the sage. It wants to be recognized. Recognized as this ego as a separate self. So love is a subject truly worthy of deep contemplation and introspection as far as our own journeys are concerned and its relation to our state of equanimity and peace and harmony. All right. If anyone would like to share anything or ask anything, they can do so now. Yes, Mina.
Hey, namaste again. Hello. First of all, a couple of things, and these aren't really questions. These are more just like I just want to let everybody know, because I've done some like research and it was just really interesting what I found, and I just wanted to share it with Gotham and also everybody else. Because like a central tenet of Gotham's teachings, or well, he's passing on the teachings of the rishis and the sages, is that there is no free will, right? And everything is God's will. And sometimes when I first heard that, right, it was a little bit, I agree, it was a little bit difficult for me to accept that. I just feel like I'm someone who wants like maybe a more scientific basis to things. I like to look at it more scientifically, and so I get a little bit curious about like the scientific aspect. And so I went ahead and did like some researching into that. Interestingly, what I do want to let you know is that there is this professor. Okay, his name is Robert, Robert. His last name is like Sapolsky or something, Sapolsky. Sapolsky. He is a Stanford professor. He is a neuroscientist, so incredibly like very, very renowned, and he has done so much research on this. In addition to that, he's an atheist. So he is very neutral on this. All of his research, all of the evidence that he's come up with has nothing to do with any religion. He's definitely big on proponent on the fact that we have no free will. So just so everybody knows, there's big science coming up about this too. I feel like this is going to go in that direction. I know that, the purpose of all this is to be very spiritual, but I just think it's very interesting that if we were to kind of go in a direction as a society, just on the pure basis of science too, that there is no free will, just from the basis of science. So a lot of his talks are very interesting because he says a lot of the same. It's like science and spirituality are literally intersecting, because what Gotham says is like, there is no free will because everything is based on conditioning and genetics, and that's God's will. The only thing that Robert or this professor says is like he doesn't believe in God, so he doesn't talk about that. But essentially, he's saying the same thing. He's like, yeah, it's all like the way he's putting it is like we're all just like species, and everything is all about genetics and conditioning. And so, like, even what happens in while we're in our mother's womb. So he explains it very scientifically because he's a scientist. So he's like, literally, what happens in our mom's womb affects our brains, and then when we grow up, like that, our biology is literally based off of what's happening in the womb. And so we literally have no free will. That was just one of the examples that he was talking about. So that's one thing I just want to let everybody know, to if someone's even curious about that, that there's big science in this. And then second of all, I do want to let you know, this is more for you, Gotham, is that nowadays your teachings tend to play on my mind so much that whenever I do go on about my daily interactions, and whenever I find myself getting upset or angry over something or someone, you, by the way, play big in my mind. I can totally hear you say on the back of my mind, it's all God's will. And it's like, just like that God's will, it's like just plays in my mind really, really deeply. Like it plays on my mind so much, and it is affecting me very, very deeply, and it is affecting my daily interactions. So thank you for that. Which then leads me to my question that I want to ask, which is that if there's so much emphasis on God's will and everything being God's will, where does the concept of prayer comes into this, right? So if we were to pray for something, but we know it's God's will, right? How can we approach the concept of prayer at the same time acknowledging and honoring God's will? So that's my question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mina. And you see, one thing to clarify is that God's will is presented as the opposite of my free will, so that the ego, which thinks it has been the whole and sole responsible for its actions and therefore the results, seeing life as it unfolds, knowing that life is pleasure sometimes, pain sometimes, and it really does not have much control over life as it flows. When we bring in this concept of God's will as the opposite of my will, a realization happens. It's a step back. that, oh yes, there's this higher power which is at play. That is why the teachings bring in God's will. It is really not about there's no free will and there's only God's will. Free will is now seen as the mechanism of functioning in daily living because I still have to do things in life. I have to take decisions and things have to be done through me. But the burden of that free will, which I had earlier, that weight, which led to guilt and shame or pride and arrogance, that is no longer functioning. So the teaching introduces God's will as the polaric opposite of my will. But ultimately, both these drop away. You see, and there's a total acceptance of the one larger picture, which is what is in the moment. So that is how it functions. And that is why it is so appealing that there's something which is beyond my personal will, because it's my life's experience. Things never go the way I want them to all the time. So this starts becoming a humbling thought, and it removes the burden of expectation of outcomes. The daily living becomes so much more freer that all I can do is try to influence a situation based on what I feel I should say and do. But ultimately, since I am also not the doer, things will happen the way they are meant to. And this results in equanimity and calm. That is what happens.
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize I was mute. Sorry. I guess my question, just to sort of clarify my question, what I wanted to ask was that, so basically when I talk about prayer and you're saying that
Yes.
there's the free will in daily living, that mechanism has to be there. So I guess the answer to my question is it's okay to pray. Because I mean, yeah, like if I'm asking God for something, ultimately knowing the outcome is God's will, but it's okay to pray because even that praying is God's will, actually.
Yes, it is okay to pray, but when the understanding sinks from the mind to the heart, the prayers which tend to arise are spontaneous prayers. For example, you hear someone's not well and there's a wish, oh, this person, I hope they get better. It is no longer a prayer of begging, which is what my teacher would say. Most of our prayers are prayers of begging and asking God for things. That kind of prayer drops away. And what one is left with is a spontaneous prayer without an agenda. Most of us have a list of things to ask of God at night, point number one, point number two. Money, relationships, this, that, and all. But when we start resting and sinking in this glorious field of pure being and presence, knowing that the divine will prevail, those kind of prayers start dissolving. That is what happens. And my teacher would say that the true prayer which starts arising is, oh Lord, let me see you behind it all. That is it. That is the true prayer. In his letter to God, which he wrote when he was 83 years old, he lived till the age of 92. When I read that, he had written, "Dear Lord, give me a state of mind in which I would not want anything from anyone. And not even from you. Because all wants are the egoic wants, most of them. So a total acceptance of life as it flows, daily living, leads to lesser and lesser prayers for those mundane things. But prayer can certainly arise in any form. Its quality is now different. All right.
Got it. That answers my question. Thank you. Namaste, Gautam. Thank
Namaste.
you.
Yes, Gita.
Namaste, Gautam ji.
Namaste.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful topic. You have that really I've been wanting to know so much about This is love itself. And what I think I am just gathering from your teachings is that love is just giving acceptance to Lord's will, that is, thy will be done, as you say. And which we say as prasad buddhi or hari ichha. So, like what Advaita in its culmination, uski jo parakashtha pe, it is prema bhakti. And when prema bhakti, or vice versa, the prema bhakti, when it culminates, it is Advaita, it is gyan. So, they are two sides of the same coin, and it can't be different. I mean, Advaita, just merely words and explanations will lead you nowhere. Just intellectually, will be more miserable. And but if it culminates into love, that is the purity, that is the true essence of Advaita. And in bhakti also, it leads to, ultimately, it has to lead to gyan. So, and they say, like you said, that kisi se dvesh bhavna nahi rakhni chahiye, no hatred and no attachment. I mean, that is like we say, na kahu se dosti, na kahu se bair. When you are seeing that common denominator in each of us, I mean, in the world. So, it is a beautiful leela, sai leela. I mean, in the world of duality, it is just only Leela, but like seeing gold in all ornaments. And if you have that vision, which you were saying, the Shiva's eye, the eye of wisdom, so there's peace and in daily living, and peace is God. Om Shanti. This is, I think, what you said, you conveyed it so beautifully. And like the She's talking about the prayer. So we, as we pray to God, I think most of our prayers are like having a business with God. The longer the list, the longer the salutations. So I think prayer becomes more silent.
Yes, well said, well said. Beautifully expressed. And you know, it is in our daily living that we find that the proof of the pudding is in the eating. We will know for
Absolutely.
ourselves through our relationships where we stand as far as Prem Bhakti. Advaita Bhakti is concerned. We will know for ourselves.
Absolutely. It is living. I mean, all the teachings have to be lived. So, like you said, it is pray. So when it love is God and God is love, so we become one with that. So like you said, Osho said, it is cool love. So that is also something like Om Shanti. I mean, this all total peace when you are totally one with the substratum. So it is what we describe in different words, I guess.
It is beautiful.
I mean, it's so wonderful to have so much of this deep meaning through you. I mean, it is our privilege always to have so much of insight, deep insight from your satsangs. So that is what I wanted to know. Anything you could just, I mean, say what I think love has to convey. I mean,
No, I think you have expressed it very beautifully. And I like that line, love is Om Shanti.
yeah,
Start using that. Thank you
Om
very much
peace.
for your sharing. Thank you,
Thank
Geeta.
you, thank you, thank you, Gautam.
Yes, Ishwar.
Hi, everyone.
Not in
So,
that's Ishwar, right?
so the teachings or the what you want to convey or whatever we go through this path, right? Everything feels so right and so true when we are going to the teaching, but when it comes to day-to-day living, right? That's the hard part. Like we don't means we don't see any translation of that. Like once we are like here, we feel like okay, we are somewhere a little bit above or whatever. But when we are like from here, if we go and then start living the day routine daily life, we don't feel that we are taking something from here and making something better. So how do we do that better? I don't know. And I don't know whether it is because of this path, I'm feeling very say disinterested in the life altogether. Nothing interests more, or maybe I feel very say disinterested in everything. Nothing excites me more nowadays. So how do you see this? How it is affecting, or it is the nature of this path itself?
Well, the first part of your question is if you find it's difficult to translate this into daily living, that happens because while the intention is there, the old conditioning is still operating very strongly. That is why my teacher would suggest to a lot of people when they would visit his satsangs that at the end of the day, look at the events during the day and see them in light of this teaching, that nobody is the doer of their actions. And they would take that as a practice. And by, that would become the new way of seeing the happenings in their lives. So this is for you to see that is it just the old conditioning is so strong that it is not allowing this new way of seeing as far as daily living is concerned, or maybe I'm not really giving myself the chance to reflect on the events of the day and see them in the new light. This only you would know. But that is what tends to happen, that it takes time. It takes a lot of time for, because let's not forget, this teaching or any wisdom teaching one comes across is new conditioning. This new conditioning will override the old conditioning. But it is a question of time. Unless there's no interest and there's a half-baked application, one could call it, which would also be God's will. And then you feel, oh, this particular path is not for me because it's not making any difference. You see, now to repeat that, only you would know. Because if something has appealed to you, that means it has already had an impact. But the implementation also has to be considered. That is what we always refer to as this example of getting the driver's license is one thing, but driving through heavy traffic and being comfortable driving through heavy traffic is going to take time and practice. That is how it works. Disinterestedness arises because one no longer derives sustenance from the mundane world. Someone who has faced many setbacks in life, especially when they are young, such a person will automatically veer towards the spiritual path because he has seen the transient nature of life and how fickle everything is. There's no permanency there. It is shifting sands, moving all the time, sometimes up, sometimes down. And so a disinterestedness in the mundane, knowing that I cannot find true happiness through mundane life, starts setting in. Yet, we have to ask ourselves, is that the reason for the disinterestedness, or is it other factors? Like perhaps I'm repeatedly not doing well in my job, or I'm always losing money on the stock market, and so I'm going into this, and now this spiritual teaching has come in saying everything is God's will. You see, the ego can go into a tailspin as well. So, this, I would not say that this teaching makes one less engaged in daily living. In fact, it is the opposite. When one is no longer attached to the results, as the Gita says, And when there's the full understanding, everything is God's will, the burden of the thinking mind is no longer there. And then one is completely in the present moment and totally engaged with what is. But yes, there's no attachment to it. In that sense, there's disinterestedness. But otherwise, my working mind is functioning in pristine purity, no matter what job I am doing, because it is not overridden by the thinking mind, which is living in the dead past or an imaginary future, and always thinking that it's the doer of the actions. That has dissolved. So this is a question we have to ask. Everyone who's listening to this talk has to ask themselves that what is this quality of disinterestedness if I am feeling it and facing it? It has to be looked at.
Okay. Yeah.
Answer your question.
Yeah. Bang on. I think it was like to the point what I was means where I was coming from. I think you got it exactly the what I was expecting it to be answered the way it was. So it was really nice and it was really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That's the beauty of satsang, you know. It just Satsang is the dissolving of questions and doubts. That is what happens through the light of truth. And you
Thank
see,
you.
when one person's question is answered, many other questions get answered because the human experience is one. We are all facing the same doubts, the same questions, the same issues. So it is a gift for everyone. That is the real beauty of satsang, coming together on this journey of understanding life and what it is all about. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, Dipti.
Namaste, Gautam ji. First of all, thank you. Like Meena said, your satsang are so helpful in daily living. Just a few days back, I just got stuck in some situation where your last satsang, two lines that were really helpful for me was like, one was, Thy will be done, and the second was, This shall too pass. So, again, thank you once again. And one of my question has been already answered by you. And another question is like, peace is one thing, but when you say if I'm on Bhakti Marg and I still can't see equanimity in my daily living at each level, that means still I'm not able to see everyone with the eye of singularity or eye of Shiva, you mean? And in that case, again, what should be steps that I can take care of? That's my
Yes.
question. Thank you.
So this too shall pass and thy will be done are the words in the Bible. So we have to thank those teachings, which are the universal
True.
teachings, you know. So they are so fundamental to understanding life. That's why I say the truth is so simple. There's such beauty in simplicity. And when these are like mantras, thy will be done, this too shall pass. Are like mantras. Anything we face in life, if these two mantras emerge, what more do we need? That it's actually the start and end of everything, as far as I think it is very beautiful, very deep. And you see, this translation of bhakti into daily living, the question you asked, how can we help the process or aid it? The only way to help it is not to hinder it. The only way to help it is not to hinder it. We have to allow what has appealed to us to translate itself into daily living. We do not have to make a project out of it. We don't have to make studies for an exam which we need to pass. That is how the ego operates. By and by, in the day, if I come across a situation, that is my opportunity. Or even if I miss the opportunity because of old conditioning, I sit by myself for 15 minutes at the end of the day. I reflect upon that happening. What did I say? What was it based on? Was it based on my old conditioning, old understanding? So this is the process of reflection and contemplation, which should be a comfortable one, not a stressful one. We should not put this added pressure on ourselves. That is my only suggestion, that if these teachings have appealed to you so far, they will do the job themselves, but they need to be given that space. And that space which is given is also a space where one does not judge oneself. All right. Dipti, do you want to ask anything else, or does that answer your question? Sorry,
Yes, Gautamji. I was not able to unmute. Absolutely, apt answer, Gautamji. So contemplation is the key. I need more of contemplation, but without feeling pressurized or stressed. Yeah. Thank you.
yes. And I can
Thank
see
you.
the Lord
Namaste.
Krishna behind you, so I don't think you have
Yeah.
to
Absolutely. Always with us. Thank you, Gautamji.
Yes, Suresh.
Hariom Gautam ji, this is my first lecture listening to you live, and my pranams to you. It's such a pleasure to be in this event. I think my first lecture that I heard on YouTube was on Runanubandhan of yours. So I believe there is some bond, so which is why I'm here. I saw your picture like almost 5 years ago, but the time is now that I've turned to your teachings. The one that sealed for me was your lecture on Sri Ramana Maharishi, and also what true meditation is. And one point which was a stunner was you gave an example where in the railway station, people are coming out, and that's how thoughts are. And would you ask everybody to stop, or would you find your way through that? That was such an eye-opener. So I started regularly following your teachings, and I saw subscribed, and I saw that you had a Sunday satsang. I lived in Bombay for many years, and I'm like, man, I don't have the opportunity to visit you. And here I am on a live session. So thank you so much for that. Today, the one thing that I took, which was a brilliant reference, was accepting myself and where I am in my spiritual journey. After listening to all of your lectures, there is so much of peace and quietude that I've gotten. It has sunk into my heart. So I'm like, have accepted my relationships and things in a very true way. My question was, am I right to see if I noticed any improvements, to tell people that here is an opportunity for you to improve, because that is not fully accepting them also? Or how do I see that? I'm okay to accept it and leave it to his will, but I just raised my hand just to talk to you. That is the truth. Thank you.
Thank you. Where are you based now?
I live in New Jersey in the US.
Okay. So it's a very important question you have asked. If I feel the need to express myself, if that is my nature, that if I see someone or something and I feel this need to express myself, that has to be honored. Because it is not my feeling. But you see, there is a very important point here. In this expression, I will know that it is still only my view. It is not the truth. Generally, when we express ourselves and tell people things without them asking us, we feel that our view is right. That arrogance goes. I still have a feeling I want to tell someone something. I still honor that because that's what's coming naturally. But now I know whether that person takes my expression and my advice is God's will. Whether that expression or advice leads to something or not, God's will. So I am no longer in a situation where I am trying to convince the other person that what I am expressing is the way they must feel and think and do things. That burden is gone. Then you could say I am an equal expression of the divine. If I find myself repeating myself, expressing the same thing again and again to the same person, then very clearly the ego is invested not only in its opinion, but in the outcome to the extent that I can start creating suffering for the other person. You see? These are very important points to take note of. Or am I very light about my expression? I tell someone something and I leave it. And the words I choose, are those words coming from a judgment on what the person said, how they are and what they do? Or are they more from an understanding of life, seeing what is behind the words people say, and in a sense of felt oneness or compassion, my expression arises. This is how one could approach expression. Now, the other end of the spectrum is what my guru would say, never give advice unless asked for. You see, because it's such a tricky thing to give advice. Now, okay, a boss can advise the junior, parent advises the child because they have seen more of life, more experience. That is different. When we are talking about Rinanubandhan, engagement people, that's what we are referring to. Because if we are not in this awareness that my advice is based on my conditioning and my filters, it may not be the right advice.
Yes.
Then a sense of humility sets in. And then again find that while I am expressing myself because I'm honoring the expression which is wanting to happen, there's a quality of humility in it. So everything changes, Suresh. The words I choose, the way I express myself, because they are not being targeted at an individual. Because now I know that this person is an equal representation of the divine. All I'm doing is my life's experience, my insights, my understanding is being offered. It's being offered to their consciousness in the hope, maybe, that they see things in a certain way. So it's a more gentle way of expressing myself, rather than trying to force something down someone's throat, which is what we tend to do. My way or the highway.
Totally. I've changed. I don't say advice anymore. I just say suggestion. And I've also. You know, I wait if somebody is really asking for my suggestion. So I've stopped that impromptu me going out. I just have one follow-up question, if you don't mind. In the process of, so I learned some Vedas from my dad, and I used to be fond of chanting and prayers. And in the last few months, as the teaching has evolved, I'm more at peace just being silent and being like just, I don't know how to say it. It's just the shad of the Upanishad, just being just like that. And now even the mantras, I don't want to chant it, but I want to just only chant it internally. Is there any indication, or is am I going in the right path? Thank you.
Well, according to me, that is all the indication you need. It's the quietening of the mind and the heart. Even the mantra is left alone now. Rather than you doing the mantra or chanting the mantra, let the mantra arise when it is meant to. That is called the Ajapaja. When it is meant to arise, it arises. Otherwise, I am in peace, calm, and quiet. Isn't that, to me, that is the most beautiful state to be in. It is so close to the principles and tenets of non-doership. That is where I find my peace. If you had said that I'm in that silence, but my thinking mind is going on all the time, then we have a conflict there. But when the thinking mind has died down and is dissolving, being annihilated by these teachings, it is but natural to be resting in the, as Robert Adams would call it, the silence of the heart. I think it's, thank you. You've expressed yourself very beautifully. I'm quite blessed today to have so many of you expressing yourself so clearly, and that gives me tremendous joy.
Thank you. Hari Om.
Thank you. We'll take a couple more questions. Sneha, is it possible for you to not move the camera so much?
Sorry.
Hello? Sneha, I don't know if you're in a moving vehicle, but I am not able to hear you clearly, and plus your audio is...
Namaste, sir.
Namaste.
Hi, sir, I have been watching your videos, and those have been so enlightening and peaceful. And thank you so much to you and your team for giving me this platform to interact with you directly today. And today's explanation was so beautiful and helpful in practicing oneness with God and others. I have been a devotee of Sai Baba since the last many years. And recently I was watching one video of yours in which you were discussing pointers on the letters of Anna Sahib. And there was a discussion was started, but it could not be completed at that time. And that was regarding, I think, some siddhis you were started to speak. And you were saying that Sai Baba discouraged people who came with siddhis to him or something like that. It was, I could not get it properly. So I would like to you to throw some light on that, whether attending siddhis bring us closer to God or not, and whether we should listen to the, something you were saying that we should listen to them or not about that. Please throw some light on that.
Well, siddhis is a separate topic, and Sai Baba has, in fact, let me see if I can find a line or two to read out to you from the same book. But it is going to come up in future videos, so on the Sai Baba channel, so you can wait for that. But I will just read out to you something which appealed to me. You see, I'm not able to find that right now, but if you are only offering Sukha Shanti to someone, what is the use of siddhis? Siddhis are to impress people, to manipulate them, to make them feel you are special. So that is why Sai Baba has constantly hammered this point. Stay away from those who are performing siddhis. Even there was a phase when Nisargadatta Maharaj was able to perform siddhis, and his guru Siddharameshwar Maharaj told him, please stop doing that. This is not the reason why you are here. Although it was to help people, his own guru told him to stop that. Why? because it takes away from the core and essence of Baba's teachings. That all is not required at all. And that is why his famous words, I give people what they want so that they may want what I want to give them. What is that which he would want to give us? Self-realization, you could call it enlightenment, or simply sukha shanti. So this relentless focus on just that and no deviation from the path is what is being referred to and on the subject of siddhis. Now, some beings, when they get realized, they find spontaneous siddhis arising, but they have no interest in displaying those siddhis to acquire more disciples or to get attention to themselves. It is an act of spontaneity which happens. So that you can explore this further by reading this book, The Jewel of Sai Devotion, and by, it is a series of videos we have done, Nikhil and me, on his channel. I think only one or two are released so far, and by the others will get released too. All right?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Yes, Shiva.
Hi, sir. Good morning. I want to you know, share my experiences after going through your and Ramesh sir's videos. So actually, throughout my life, I have experienced a roller coasters of ups and downs since my childhood, and there have been times, instances where I worked tirelessly towards my goal, but only to face significant failures. And conversely, and there were moments when things fell, you know, perfectly into place with a very minimal effort. So this journey left me, you know, deeply, you know, perplexed about the workings of life. So from the age of 15, I embarked on the spiritual quest and seeking answers to this. And my path, you know, led me to various ashrams across India, many ashrams. Even I took a break from my job for 3 years and to wander, you know, wander through Himalayas, and even I visited Kailash Manasarovar. But despite these experiences, you know, each spiritual experience would make me more egoistic and, you know, restless to have a more taste of it. And I remained plunged by doubts and confusion. So it was around 2020, during COVID. One of my cousin introduced me to the teachings of Ramesh Balsekar, and through his videos, and I mean, everything got changed. And it answered all my questions. His insights addressed all my doubts and confusion, freeing me from ego, shame, guilt associated with the past actions. And since embarking his teachings, I have found a profound peace and tranquility into my life. And by going through his teachings, I got introduced to you, and I have been following you through last 1.5 years, and I found it very peaceful. Yeah, I'm really immensely grateful to you and Ramesh Basrekar sir for their teachings.
Yeah, thank you. That's very beautiful. And the thing with this peace is, as I say, peace is not an experience.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful to be immersed in that peace, which is not an experience, because all experiences come and go.
Yes, correct.
No, it is so beautiful. And therefore, because it is not an experience in that sense, it is underrated.
Yes.
Nobody wants something as dull as peace.
Yes.
Only the one who has seen ups and downs in life, been through the spiritual journey, been there, done that, whether it is places, whether it is teachers and all, will know for themselves the value of this peace. And this peace is the final ashram.
Yes.
Ashram
yes.
is in.
Yes. Yes, I felt immense peace. Actually, I went through many, many yogic, I practiced many yogic meditations, even tantric, and did a lot of circus throughout my life, and lastly in despair. So the only place where I got an immense peace and tranquility and the bliss is in other way the teachings of you and Ramesh sir's teachings.
And your real name is Shiva?
Yes, my name is Shiva Basav, so I made short Shiva.
Well, I'm very happy that Shiva is actually putting a stamp on what I have been talking about, which is so fine. What more do I want?
No, this is my because I have gone through many spiritual organizations and many teachings, but this is where I found found myself, get purified from guilt, shame, and ego. So and yeah, since then my relationship with others, my colleagues and family members has changed. Now there's a total acceptance of my life and the surrounding.
Yes, as someone mentioned earlier, life becomes love as love is Om Shanti and love as Om Shanti.
Yes, that's true.
Anyone you meet, the one who upsets you, the one you love, Om Shanti.
Yes, correct, right. It was put perfectly fine.
Yes, thank you. Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much
for thank you.
About thank you. Where are you based?
I am currently based in Pune, but I am basically from Belgaum, Karnataka.
Sure. And now you have a job?
Yes, currently, yes.
Okay.
I have been working now since 2010. I have been working. So I took a three years of break to know what it is exactly and went through many places. And then again, but lastly, I found peace in your teachings. Advaita teachings.
Oh, lucky you could take a 3-year break because many people after 3 years may not be able to find a job.
Yes, yes, I found it immediately. The moment I decided that I should go back to ITM and to go back to job, but then within 2 months I got a job, and now I'm in a good position.
Great.
So, yeah.
Because after all, we have to be pragmatic about these teachings, right?
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay. There's, I think there's one raised hand left. Yes, Geeta, we can take this as the last one thing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Wanted to ask you one question, which I forgot. That is, like I've read, that question had been really churning in my mind. Gyan bandhanaha, it is like knowledge is bondage. So I just want to have your view on your say on that.
Knowledge is bondage if I'm not living it. Then it is a theory which I get bound to and create an identity out of it, and it could make me arrogant.
Okay.
Knowledge is not bondage if it is a lived knowledge in my daily living, which transforms not only relationships, but the way I see life and the events in my life. Then there's no question of bondage of knowledge. If I read too many scriptures, if I feel I know more than others, if I'm able to recite shlokas, but it has had no impact on my daily living, on my sukha shanti, then it is a bondage. All right.
Okay, so thank you so much. Yeah, it was. Thank you.
All right, we'll just sit in silence for a minute or so. Those who would like to switch their cameras on are welcome to do so in case it is off, so I can see everyone. You see, as I think Suresh expressed it very well, ultimately, we find our daily living is becoming quieter. Nisargadatta Maharaj said, realized people are very quiet. Of course, what he meant was that because the thinking mind is quiet, one is more the screen on which the movie is seen. rather than the movie itself. One is more the page on which words appear rather than words themselves. Which means one is more and more witnessing the flow of life. Thank you.